Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working
at an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Yes, it's Party Friday. Chuck Bonnewell, Julie Hayden, Chuck and Julie, two straight up, grassroots show.
That's
or
right.
Invert to that, to the grassroots show, two straight up.
Right.
Either way, it's good.
That's right. The show is brought to you by Mountain West Wellness, Advanced Acupuncture, and Chinese Medicine. We're going to have, as soon as we get him on the phone, Chuck has been thrilled about this. Chuck is a historian.
Lord
Conrad Black, and we've got him. Yeah, he's on his new book, The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1. He is a former media mogul, a historian, author. Sir, thank you much for your time on this Friday afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Oh, we'd love to.
I have to say, if you ever played the parlor game, who would you like to go to dinner with of historical figures? And you always say, well, Napoleon and maybe Orson Welles or... Everyone, if they have one for today, I'd like to go to dinner with Lord Black, because he's led an extraordinary life of huge highs, incredible lows, and great resilience. So it's so, what a thrill to have you on.
Well, yeah, look, the pleasure is mine. And anytime you want dinner, just invite me.
Oh, there
okay.
You go.
Well, here.
Go to the spaghetti factory because our
tonight. Are you in Denver?
I don't think I could get there on time.
Yeah, well, that's a great place, but we'll find someplace fancier.
No, I know it. It's a lovely city. I've been there, but I'm in Canada right now.
There you go. Well, Chuck, as I mentioned, is not even just a history buff. He's a history expert. And so when I said, oh, my gosh, Sandy is saying, hey, Lord Conrad Black has a new book out. Chuck is like, book him. So I'll just let Chuck take it away.
All right. Well, you've written the history of the world. I guess it's the political and strategic history of the world. Tell us how you decided to take on this monumental task, 3 volumes, which is really very short for a history of the world. Why did you decide to do this tremendous task?
Well, you see, I started out as a historical writer, writing biographies in particular. I mean, if people be familiar to your listeners, President
Richard
Franklin
Nixon.
D. Roosevelt and President Nixon and President Trump. And the latter two I knew, you see, Mr. Nixon in his last 5 years. I've known Mr. Trump for many years. And then I wrote a history, but it was a strategic history of the United States. And Henry Kissinger was kind enough to write a foreword for me. And so I saw how the idea worked, where you're not purporting to give, you know, the cultural history or the social history, particularly, obviously, to a degree they come into it. But you're essentially describing how the country evolves politically. Then I wrote a history of Canada. And so I thought, because a lot of the research I'd done was in these very, very multi-volume histories compiled by some of the major universities.
Cambridge,
for example.
Cambridge,
well, there's a perfect example. At Cambridge, ancient, medieval, and modern histories combined are about 30 volumes and nearly 30,000 pages. And so it gives you, you know, nearly 15 to 20 million words. Well, I've read a lot of this kind of thing, and I concluded, since I'm getting a little older, that I wanted to write my sort of magnum opus, my main work, you see. And I thought, you know, written on the way I wrote my strategic history of the U.S., so you're not claiming to give every aspect of the country's history,
right.
This could be done for the world in a much, much shorter and, frankly, more readable way than these huge official histories. So it's a project not just to cover the material, which of course is immense, but present it in a way that's readable and interesting and doesn't put you to sleep after after 5 pages. So you're really focusing on not, you know, you're giving a narrative, a chronology, but right. but not a laborious one, and focusing on the more colorful and flamboyant and important personalities. And that way, history is made interesting. And I mean, you can't write about someone like Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar and make it dull. You know, because you know they're very interesting men, and so it became a challenge of compression without being glib or just too syncopated, but a challenge of presentation to make it interesting, I don't want to be self-serving here, but I'm three quarters of the way through writing the second volume. I'm up to the time of Shakespeare, Queen Elizabeth, and. In my opinion, again, I realize I'm a little partial here. It's for the most part a reasonably readable account all the way through, and I am going to get it through it in the whole thing in three volumes. So anyone who buys it, you can read the chapters are on distinct, separate things. So you don't have you can read one chapter even. Part of a chapter because they're all broken up in sections and then put it down again for 3 years, but it's there on your shelf. And if you want to look something up without relying on Wikipedia, which isn't very reliable sometimes, there it is. You see, it's all in the index.
Well, I have picked up your book.
Yeah, the day we booked you, we bought it. So,
and I must admit, it's 1,000 pages long, so I haven't made it all the way through. But I enjoyed very much what I've read, and certainly it's very interesting. In the beginning, you cover the history of the Semitic people, and in particular the Jewish people, and the Bible and the Torah, or I guess their Genesis, and all the way through. And your parents, I understand, were agnostic or atheist, but you're a person of faith. And so, most people you read today are academics and they're all atheists. So it is, you don't get much of anything else when they write. But yours is fascinating and assumes, which I assume, that the Bible was written by people who were trying to tell to the best they could, not that they were perfect or anything, and depending upon an oral traditions for 1,000 years, but it wasn't something just made up during the Babylon captivity to make the Jews feel good about themselves while they're under slavery of the Babylonians. But it was
and it wasn't a myth-making operation by the apostles to try and convert everybody. But I want to emphasize, I do my best to separate lore from reliable historical fact, and it is in that period that you make the crossover from stories passed on over the generations to things that there there's some written evidence of or something to go by, and where we're in very uncertain ground. I say that this has to be.
Yeah.
Read with caution, this sort of thing.
But the most of Jewish history up until maybe Hellenistic
2000. They say they've been here for 5,700 years, and they have. But the first half of it is you can't be sure how much of it happened,
Yeah, but it is an attempt by people, very bright people. Based on oral traditions passed down, and that's just like telephone, it can get garbled. Sure. But they were trying to tell the history of the Jewish people. They weren't trying to make up the history of the Jewish people.
And you can see that important parts of it were almost certainly true. And maybe not absolutely exactly true, but they, as you say, they weren't just made up out of whole cloth. They're based on something.
I mean, Passover is a celebration beheld by Jewish people for thousands of years now. Did it come from nothing? Did they just make it up during the Babylonian period? I don't think so.
There is some meteorological evidence that at the time of the crossing the Red Sea,
the water levels
were low, and they may have been able to wade through part of it,
Yeah. And so their attempt to tell a story of their people, or wherever you want to call it, and it's, there was zero evidence of Solomon and David, and more recently something.
There's plenty of evidence of those two.
But there was none when I studied it, except they found an artifact saying House of David. I don't think anybody thinks that's made up, but nonetheless, a lot of people think that Moses was made up, and I don't think he was. Was he the Moses of Charlton Heston? No. But did they
or Disney
or Disney prince of, and but did they, you know, were part of enslaved in Egypt? Probably a lot of people were during famine years. Did they break out? Yes, they probably did. Were there 600 million of them? No, there's probably a much smaller group. But they, you know, they got to Jericho and invaded Canaanite and Philistine lands.
Yeah, a very brilliant strategic move, moving straight east and then north and then west.
get him from the back.
When I said there's proof of Solomon, I didn't mean there was documentary evidence of all of it. What I meant was there's no doubt he existed. And there is reasonable agreement on many aspects of his career. I didn't mean to suggest that it's all there to see, like, for example, President Eisenhower or something. It's something like that.
We're talking about, I've been seeing, sir, we have people join us on Zoom, so I just want to let people know we're talking with Lord Conrad Black about his new book, The Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1. I'm curious, so you said, you know, this is a strategic history, a political and strategic history, and it seems you start with religion or the origins of some religion. Is that fair? And if so, if it's wrong, correct me, but if it is right, why'd you start there?
I'm sorry, I started where?
Well, you start talking about to just talk about the political and strategic history of the world. You know, you don't you start with some of the early religions, basically, right?
No.
Okay.
No, he's telling the story. Correct me if wrong. You're telling the story because the Bible is the one that recites.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Recites.
Yeah,
it.
You see, I'm trying to get civilizations that we have any notion of. I mean,
yes.
We have absolutely no idea, none, what was going on in Japan at that time. You know, I'm talking about 5,000 years ago, and or the middle of Asia, you say, or middle of Africa. But so what I'm doing is I'm starting from the origins of history sufficiently reliable that it isn't just made up, and we've got three centers: the Middle East, Mesopotamia, and India and China, and that's where I start, and then Egypt right afterwards, and
right.
then we, you know, then it grows and we get into Europe and so on, from then on I go on the basis of bringing in places as the places I started with come into contact with them. So I'm now writing in the 17th century, and I'm starting to refer to Latin America and other places that have been parts of Africa. And as it goes along, well, there's only one chapter dealing with India and China in this volume. There are more in the next volume. And so it just becomes a larger world from the Western perspective. But I'm trying to deal with those places that had the origins of a political society. And the strategic part is how they... Chuck just described how the Jews moved from Egypt, and in order to regain the so-called promised land, instead of going there in a straight line, they went around and actually approached it from the east. And that's the strategy, you see, a not very primitive, simple aspect. But when you get to Rome, for example, every element of the expansion of Rome had a strategic aspect to it, both why they wanted to do it and how they did it. So that's why it's not to be to give it a pretentious or a long title, but I'm just trying to be accurate. That's all.
Well, going to one more esoteric one, that'd be probably a dinner conversation. You indicated in your foreword that you think there's an upward tilt to humanity, that our political systems are better, we're more humane, more logical. I must admit,
yes.
I have not found that to be the truth.
I disagree with Chuck. This is
Julie totally agrees with you.
Going debate between
Julie totally agrees with you.
So why don't you bolster my case? No, why do you think that?
Well, because in the earlier chapters, there basically foreign relations consisted of one group thinking that it's stronger than the neighboring group and attacking it for no reason at all. There's no, as we would say now, a casus belli, a cause of war. It's just, you know, we think we can take over their country and plunder them, so let's do it. And That, you know, you may well say that's what's going on in the Ukraine right now, but
yes, that's exactly what's going on. NATO decided it wants to dissolve Russia.
I'm not saying it's not happening. What I'm saying is that gradually we have developed this more civilized way of dealing between groups of people. And I mean, just take the one volume that's out there that you, and I'm very impressed that you've read as much in it as you have. I mean, as you know, I'm having a lot of discussions with people like this and in around the United States and Canada. And I don't think anyone has read as much of it as you apparently have. But from those early Mesopotamian tribes, where when one side lost, they just massacred the losers. And, you know, there was one, you might have seen that one case where somebody got so angry at the person he defeated that he tortured him, decapitated him, stuck his head in a tree, and ultimately took the skull down and urinated on it. Now, you know, things like that really don't happen now, or not I don't think.
You think the Palestinians got a hold of Netanyahu today, his head wouldn't be up on a tree and them urinating him? How did Gaddafi die? He didn't die exactly a nice death.
No. I believe me, I'm not suggesting we've transformed ourselves into angels or anything. I'm just saying that standards of civility have improved, and in large part, they have improved because of the introduction of religious thinking to the view that the human life does have some dignity and deserves to be treated with some dignity. But my point is that that's how things were at the beginning of this book. But at the end of it, Augustus's empire, just, you know, the last days prior to the beginning of the Christian era and up to 14 AD when the emperor
died.
You could frankly get a letter from Rome to what is now Istanbul in about the same time it would get there today, unless you had it couriered. And obviously they didn't have emails and everything, but you could go from Portugal to Iraq on fine Roman roads without any fear of being robbed or beaten up or anything. And this was remarkable progress in the period I'm covering here.
Because, let me give you a contrary. That's Pax Romana, the area of Pax Romana under Caesar Augustus.
Real Pax Romana was, you know, with Trajan and Hadrian and Marcus Aurelius.
Well, maybe a little farther, but still the period.
Century. But you're right, yeah. Pax Augusta was called, but you're right, it's the same point,
And they got that by similar to what they did what is now Israel, by slaughtering the entire population and kicking them all out in 70 AD and again in 130 AD. They just obliterated the place, and they were famous for that.
You're slightly overstating it, Chuck.
There weren't many people left in good old Israel by the time the Romans finished them off.
Like, the Romans were, in fact, for the most part, quite generous to Israel until that uprising in the time of Vespasian. And it was his son Titus that really got into the rough stuff, because the Romans felt they'd made a deal with the Jews, and the Jews double-crossed them, in effect. Now, Josephus survived and gives a comparatively pro-Roman version of it, but it is a little more complicated than what you just said.
The
decline in the Jewish population wasn't due to the Romans. It was due to the Jews becoming Christians.
Well, the Romans didn't have a nice ending for the Carthaginians either. I mean, you know, sowing with salt.
That was outrageous. I agree with you. I mean, I blame the Carthaginians for starting the Punic Wars, but the Third Punic War. And this is why, incidentally, I've never supported the Cato Institute, because Cato the Elder was the author of the Third Punic War, and they had no reason at all to destroy Carthage. And Julius Caesar promised to rebuild Carthage, by the way. And one other thing.
Well, his famous phrase, Carthage must be destroyed.
That was Cato, yeah. And why should it be destroyed? There's no reason for it. But I should mention this. Julius Caesar was generous to the Jews in Rome and in Israel. And when he died, as I point out in that book, the Jews came out in great numbers to his funeral and chanted the Kaddish at his funeral. So it wouldn't be fair to say the Romans were altogether hostile to the Jews.
Well, they certainly were after the revolts in Alexandria and Crete and elsewhere, where they killed lots of Romans and Greeks. They weren't too loving of them after that.
Not to be philosophical about people rebelling against them. I agree with that. But on the other hand, the way they held that empire for so long was they reduced taxes, they reduced violence and crime, they made all the Mediterranean and east as far as Iraq and south to Ethiopia and north to Scotland, all of it, a common market. They spread prosperity, and the talented people all around the empire they put in the Roman Senate. Now, that was a long way forward, Chuck, in political science, as we're talking here, a long way forward from people decapitating their opponents and urinating on their skulls.
Well, there was more. Wait a minute. You can take this is too much fun for me. Well, you can take Athens and say that they also did wonderful things and awful things. And I mean, anybody.
Oh, I do say that.
Yes.
And you know, any place that has gets their grins from the Colosseum is kind of a bloodthirsty society.
Yeah, that was it. I agree. That was terrible. There were even the Spartacus's revolt, which of course was ludicrously misrepresented in that movie. But on the other hand, who do they have? Peter Ustinov and you know, a number of famous actors. They portrayed the individuals very well, I thought. But at the end of that,
Burt Lancaster
was the one who put it down, and he crucified thousands of people.
Yes, he did, along the road.
I don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying Rome was a civilized paradise. I'm saying it was a great deal more civilized and well organized than the tribes of Mesopotamia in 3000 BC.
And let me ask you this, because I'm not the historian Chuck is, but it's always struck me as curious that you said,
well, not slow her down though.
No, but it they created, you know, like you said, this giant marketplace. How did they do that? I mean, if you were just because we see and read so much about the prominent figures, but like if you were just like a regular person, you know, and I think it must not have been very great being a regular person back then. How did the people who were in power get them to go along with these wars what did they get out of this, you know, sort of at that time, the world marketplace? What was it like for just the regular person?
Well, do you mean anywhere around the Roman Empire?
Yeah.
Well, look, it was an improvement in this respect. What was there before the Romans took it all over? You know, you didn't have a common market. There was trading, but not you know, there were trading under certain conditions where you had to, you know, pay the equivalent of tariffs and what amounted to bribes to the people transporting in a way that was exploitive. And you were subject to being invaded by your neighbors at any point. Taxes were higher than under the Romans, and crime rates were higher. These people, all, for the most part, resisted the Romans. Take the Caesar's War in Gaul, what's now France. They went on for 10 years, and it was rough stuff. But Caesar suppressed that whole country, which was as big a population as Italy, and fierce people. But within 50 years, you couldn't chase the Gauls out of the Roman Empire. The Romans lent them Roman sophistication, virtually eliminated the crime rate, and reduced taxes, codified the law, so there was some consistency to it all. And the senior Gauls, they put in the Roman Senate and made people of great influence throughout the known world. So, I mean, it was actually, in fairness to Rome, it did improve the quality of life of all the places that took over. I mean, Spain was just a slave state run by the Carthaginians to pay for their military campaigns, to pay for the mercenaries. The Carthaginians didn't fight their own battles. They provided the generals, but not the soldiers.
Well, they took France, but Germany was a different deal.
It was a different deal. It was harder to get at. It's too much for us. No, but I just want to finish my point. I mean, the Spanish and the French, in the end, were grateful for the Romans, even though they fought tooth and nail against them at the beginning.
What was it then about the Romans that made it be like that? I mean, what was it? A person? Was it an event? Was it a combination?
Well, they had a technique, as I say. They would pacify the place. And as Chuck says, like, I mean, let's not kid ourselves. The Roman army was pretty rough stuff at times. You know, they weren't, it wasn't a Boy Scout troop. You know, a Roman legion was a rough, tough, elite military unit. And they, if they had any problem with civil populations, they tended to be harsh. There's no doubt of that.
But, yeah, they killed them all.
Sometimes they did. Yes, here, sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes. But once installed, they emphasized public works. They built roads. They built, you know, amphitheaters and things, and aqueducts so you could move drinking water around and move sewage out better. I mean, they were very advanced. Now, some of those aqueducts they built were wonders of the world at times.
Still
they
there.
They went for 200 miles and things. But so they modernized it in infrastructure terms, improved standards of education, lowered taxation, regularized the law, and the person from Gaul could go anywhere in the known world freely, no one to stop him. And I mean, as long as you know, he was going for a legitimate reason, you know, and the, you know, they could buy all sorts of things that came ultimately from China and India that they weren't getting before. And then they really, you know, the distinguished leaders in Spain or Gaul, you know, became figures in the Roman Empire. I mean, Trajan and Hadrian were Spaniards, you know, they weren't Romans. They
so
weren't
was Galba.
Italians.
So was Galba.
Sure. I mean, but they, I mean, these, do you think you, Trajan or Hadrian, they were just the second century. Do you think they would have had any such positions as they did if the Romans hadn't taken Spain over?
Huh.
Of course not.
Well, let me ask you then, going forward to modern times.
Yeah, because we only have 3 minutes left.
Well, we're have to continue this for 2 days.
No.
I'd be happy to come on again, you know.
We'd love to have you again. If you look at modern times and see how civilized and wonderful we've gotten, you know, and then you kind of go, oh, yeah, the Holocaust. Yeah, now I remember. Right. Oh, Nagasaki, Hiroshima. Oh, yeah.
Uh-oh.
Those were, mistakes were made.
Look, Chuck, no matter how familiar anyone is with it, it is almost impossible to believe that the culture of Goethe and Beethoven could do what it did under the Third Reich. It is almost impossible to believe it. Yeah. Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you know, war is war. And as Mr. Truman said, the Japanese should have thought of that before they attacked Pearl Harbor. But, you know, they did warn them. They warned them at the Potsdam Conference. We have a weapon of undreamed of destructiveness. We're going to use it on you if you don't.
Yeah.
That's an awful lot of women and children and innocent people.
Please, I will not be portrayed as some naive halfwit who thinks the world is full of saintly people who do nothing but nice things. All I'm saying is that on balance, it's a good deal less barbarous now than it was 3,000 years ago. Now, the flip side, and you touched on it, is the sophistication of our weapons has gone up so much. I mean, Mr. Churchill's phrase, the long night of Nazi barbarism made more sinister and more protracted by the light of perverted science. I mean, in 3,000 years ago, you couldn't murder 12 million people as quickly as the Germans did, or 200,000 people in 1 minute
the Mongols did a pretty good job. Tamerlane had a great death count.
The Mongols in Tamerlane, they made the Romans look like a bunch of Sunday school teachers.
Sir, you have been one. We will. Please come back.
Wonderful talking to you. Wonderful.
I've enjoyed it.
Oh, well, and I want to tell people, the Political and Strategic History of the World, Volume 1, we know you can get it on Amazon because that's where we got it. And I imagine, sir, it's all over the place, right?
Should be now, yeah.
All right. We will for sure book you back. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for coming on. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I've enjoyed it.
All right, okay. Thank you. And guys, we had so many comments here. And so thank you to everybody. We don't have time to read them
all.
I'll
read them all. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, we can read some, but I want to let folks know everybody loved him. So we will definitely have him back. And Chuck was like thrilled. And I haven't been able to use my Kindle because Chuck keeps keeps taking it.
Read a few.
We have. Okay. But I want to let folks know, because I think Thomas, just let me know when she calls in. We're going to be we're switching gears. Obviously, Mallory Rechtenbach with the Alliance Defending Freedom. I don't know if you guys have heard about the case out of Jefferson County where fifth graders were on a school trip and, you know, they assigned the kids to rooms and there were four girls to a room. And this one poor fifth grade girl.
We'll get to that.
I'm just letting people know she's coming on, was assigned to sleep with a person she was sharing a bed with, said, oh, by the way, I'm a boy. And so the school district's reaction was to tell her to shut up, to tell her not to tell her parents. And so the Alliance Defending Freedom is jumping in.
Yay for them.
All right. So we're getting all this. Let's see. Oh, there's too many here. Let's see. From Charlene, Western homogeny resorts to brutality, very uncivilized throughout the world to retain power. Thomas, our producer, says peace through copious amounts of murder. It's true. From Jacob, before the great flood, the axis of the earth was 90 degrees, and thereafter all the days were even half night and half dark, and only one season spring. Farmers only plowed their field once in 40 years, and as they say, still hands bring corruption. After the flood, the earth is now in a 28% tilt, and there are four seasons, and one landmass became many continents. We believe that one day all of the continents will become one landmass, and our Jewish Messiah will come. There is evidence the continents are coming together, although slowly. Also, there's evidence they're splitting up. Also, too, isn't there? Yeah. I mean, it so goes. Let's see. From Charlene, Jesus prophesied the fall of Israel in 70 AD. And then Thomas is again saying, as long as the ruling emperor was sane, that is a good point. They did have some kind of nut gods, didn't they? And until he was overthrown by the lieutenant or by his military. From Charlene. Romans sided with the Jews against Jesus. He must have been a real threat to both of them. He was a prince of peace. Tyrannical power cannot survive peace. Then they're talking about land masses. People are like, we can't wait to bring the guests back. Thomas is talking about the aqueducts at Byzantium that still exist today are works of wonder. And from Leo, does anyone think modern high school grads could make Roman aqueducts or roads? No, after 12 years of school, that's crazy. And now we have Mallory Rechtenbach.
All right.
So, Mallory, we just had a great guest on. He was talking about history, but I'm so thrilled to have you with the Alliance Defending Freedom. And I was talking about the Jefferson County case that you guys were involved in. And I can tell you, as the mother of a seventh grader who's been on some of these school field trips, it is appalling to me to think that you have school districts that say, oh, I'm sorry, I'm a boy, but I dress as a girl, so I'm going to be sleeping with you now. And the school district says, hey, don't tell your parents. I am so glad you guys have gotten involved. So first off, thank you for your time on this Friday afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for having me on.
Let me kind of have you start off. Why don't you explain, because you've gotten involved in a couple of different ways, or there have been a couple of different letters. Why don't you sort of explain what happened first, what you did, and then what's the latest development?
Absolutely. So the Wales family lives in Jefferson County and their children have attended Jefferson County schools. This past summer, their daughter, who was 11 years old at the time in fifth grade, went on the Jefferson County, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia trip. They had been preparing for the trip for 18 months and she had done lemonade stands and raised money and was so excited to have this first really big trip for a child her age. And before the trip, Jefferson County assigned her to stay in a room with three other children. And then the children decided which bed they were going to stay in. There were two beds, so two kids per bed. And then she gets on the trip. And on the first evening of the trip, one of the other children, the child who she was supposed to stay in a bed with that night, revealed that this child was, in fact, a boy who identified as transgender. The Wales's daughter was understandably concerned about this and uncomfortable and kind of snuck away to the bathroom and almost in tears, calls her parents and says, what do I do? I'm really uncomfortable. I can't sleep in a bed with a boy. And so eventually, after multiple requests, the teachers on the trip were able to move her to a different room. And they were just trying to do the best they could, but they were put in a really difficult situation too, because the policy of Jefferson County says that children should be roomed according to gender identity rather than sex. But the problem is parents are not told this before trips. In fact, Mr. and Mrs. Wales were told that girls would be on one floor and boys would be on another floor. And then they get on the trip and find out, well, that's not the case for the roommate of their daughter. Well, so we've gotten involved.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, so you guys got involved then. Okay.
Yeah, so we've gotten involved and we sent a letter to Jefferson County and back in December. And we're requesting something really, really simple. We're not even requesting that they completely get rid of their policy. We're requesting an opt-out for parents like Serena and Joe Wales who simply want to say, no, we do not feel comfortable having our daughter stay in the same room or the same bed with a boy who identifies as transgender. And that this could be done in a completely confidential way on the forms that you fill out as parents before the trip, where you just check a box and you say, no, I would like to opt out.
Right. Well, and then I think after you did this, am I right in that other parents have come forward with complaints and issues too? So you've sent a second letter?
Yes, that's correct. After we sent our first letter, we really received, we were kind of inundated with a lot of other parents from your community saying, wait a minute, this happened to me too. And the biggest one we heard about was Outdoor Lab, where sixth grade students go, you know, and stay in the mountains. And it's this great experience for a lot of kids, but the kids don't have any way to reach their parents. There's no phones. There are no parents on the trip. The kids are all on their own. And this exact same situation has happened at Outdoor Lab, where kids of different sexes, sixth graders, are put in the same cabin. But even more concerning than that, we found one situation where an 18-year-old high school counselor of one sex was put in a cabin with sixth graders of the opposite sex. So not only do you have different sexes, but you have a pretty significant age difference of different sexes.
Well, and you know, and I can relate to that because our son, we have he's in seventh grade now, but last year was in sixth grade and it was outdoor ed. And I just feel for this girl because for these kids, it was sixth grade. This was a huge deal, right? They had meetings with parents. They had all kinds of stuff explaining what we should or shouldn't bring. And this is, you know, from a lot of kids, including ours, and it was their first trip really away from their parents. Right. Maybe you sleep, but I mean, this is a big deal. And I tell you, he was nervous. The other kids were nervous. All the parents talked about it a lot. It never occurred to me that he might, I mean, I can tell you it would have been, because you're right, they don't have phones. They can't get hold of you, right? It would have been devastating to him and the other kids. And at sixth grade, that's such a confusing time for kids anyway. Mm-hmm. And to find out that all of a sudden.
Well, it would not have been a devastating thing if I was a sixth grade boy. Back in the age,
but I mean,
would not have been devastating.
Again, it would be such a socially awkward situation.
Well, yeah,
that you just wouldn't know what. I mean, it breaks my heart to think of this poor little girl in the bathroom crying because of some stupid policy. It's just outrageous, and I'm so glad you guys are getting involved because
your demands are so de minimis.
So people,
why have they not just said sure?
Honestly, I'm not sure. We were really hopeful to be able to work with them. And we think it's such an easy fix that, you know, if they want to have this policy, that's okay. But they have to allow parents who don't agree with this policy, specifically parents who don't agree with it on religious grounds, to be able to opt out. And they have the right, the constitutional right, to direct the upbringing and education of their children. Right. And that includes dealing with the privacy of your child and making sure that the privacy of all children are respected. And that's what we think. We think the privacy of all children should be respected and all children should be comfortable on school-sponsored trips.
So, well, how long ago was it you sent the letters? How long ago was it you sent the letters?
We sent the first one at the beginning of December, and then the second letter, the follow-up letter, was about a week ago. So we're hoping for a response by the end of January to our second letter. And we've just clarified our demands and also said, look, we've realized that this is not an isolated incident, unfortunately, and that this is happening across the district. And a lot of parents are very concerned about it. So we're really hopeful that Jefferson County will agree to an opt-out and will agree to work with its parents.
Well, and you know, and in particular, as you said, as a parent, I would be horrified because they do have older counselors there, right? Some of them who work, I think it's camp, right. One, my son went to Idra Haji, right? And that was lovely. He had a wonderful experience, right? But if you have then a transgender camp counselor who is a boy, right. A man, right? A man, not a boy, a man, then saying, well, I identify as a woman, so now he gets to sleep with a bunch of sixth grade girls. That in itself is, they're going to destroy the whole thing for everybody, right? I mean, they're going to take this outrageous right. agenda that's not even get into the fact that, oh, perhaps somebody could just take advantage of that, right? I mean, if somebody was, you know, so predisposed. It's just, it's insanity. I mean, I can't even believe that you're having a discussion. You know what I mean? That the school district didn't just say, yeah, that's a good idea.
Well, it is such a de minimis demand. I mean, it's just insane that they haven't said sure. And it's pathetic.
It really is. And we've tried hard. We've tried hard to be reasonable. You know, we're not asking for a lot here. We're really just asking for a simple opt-out. And again, you can do it in a way that isn't revealing private information about any child in the district, but it's a way that gives all children privacy. So if another family says, look, my child identifies as transgender and I would like them to stay in this room, okay, that's fine. But then you have to let other parents who are uncomfortable with that say, no, I'm not going to allow my child to stay there. And we've had a lot of calls of parents saying, you know, my child's supposed to go to outdoor lab this month. What do I do?
Right.
And
right.
they're put in a really difficult position.
Well, and again, and, you know, we're talking about the parents, but I just go back to, you know, these kids last year and my son and how nervous and anxious and yet excited he was. Mm-hmm. And it's not just parents being uncomfortable. This is parents being able to look after their children. This is a parental right. Yeah. It's a parental responsibility.
If parents have rights.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, that's what it's about, right? It's not about the parents' political agenda or political belief. Right? It's about making these fifth grade, these 11 and 12 year old kids feel comfortable and having an exciting learning experience and not this traumatic thing.
So who came up with the policy? The board of Jefferson County? Was it administrators that decided to come up? Who implemented their policy that your gender, you get to go wherever you're kind of feeling your gender is today?
It was Jefferson County. It's the board. The policy has actually been there since 2013, amazingly. And most of the parents we've talked to said they had no idea that this policy was there. And it's not something that I think any parent would normally go look for. And
right.
it's not labeled in a way that says, you know, this is on rooming. It's a policy dealing with transgender students. So you would have to read down into the policy to find where it says, oh, no, we're talking about rooming students as well in this policy. And so that's another reason why it's important for this opt-out to be on the paperwork, either before a trip or at the beginning of the school year when you're registering for the school year, so that parents are not only aware that this policy is there and that it's an option for their child to be placed with a child of the opposite sex in the same room or even in the same bed, but that they have the opportunity to opt out prior to the trip so that future kids aren't in the same predicament that the Wales's daughter was when she's hiding in the bathroom, you know, upset and uncomfortable and nervous and
yes.
kind of having a really important moment ruined.
Let's assume the absurd is that they don't give away to your reasonable demands. Would you bring in state or federal court?
Well, we would have to evaluate based on what their response is and kind of decide the next step. But we've got a lot of families who are saying, you know, we won't rest until we know that we can direct the upbringing of our kids and we can direct their education and that we can ensure that they have privacy at school trips.
Now,
well, if you're bringing by state law, there's not a single active judge who's not appointed by Democrats, and most of them, and a lot of them in recent years, are very far left. In federal court, you know, you at least have a chance. You have a chance of a not psycho judge.
What about, is this just Jefferson County, or because I know we're in a different school district, but do all school districts have this policy? Have you guys gotten any information on that?
Yeah. Good point.
It's not all school districts, but there are a lot of school districts that do, in fact, have this policy. So if you are in a different school district, I really encourage parents to not only go and read the policies, but before trips, specifically ask, you know, how do you handle students who identify as transgender? Could they be placed in the same room as a child of the opposite sex? These are questions that now, unfortunately, parents have to be really proactive about, and that they have to ask in the informational trip meetings prior to trips, when normally I don't think parents would probably think to ask these questions.
You would, I mean, you know, when we had, like I said, with our son, because it started at the end of fifth grade, they started preparing. I mean, I don't know how many meetings we went to, right? And how many lists of like what kind of, you know, like bug spray you could or couldn't bring, and what kind of snacks right. you could and couldn't bring. And they had a great deal of discussion about the sleeping arrangements, because, yeah, I mean, that's what kids were, you know, I mean, it's, they're like, bring a pillow, bring this, and, you know.
But we're in Adams County, and they yeah. certainly do the pronouns. You know, the girls get, my son mm-hmm. says it's only the girls, but, you know, they're changing their pronouns every few days.
But it is interesting, though, that my point there was kind of that the school district, I'm sure they had probably similar meetings about bug spray and snacks mm-hmm. and things like that. You'd think yeah. that at some point they could mention, oh, and because, and you could opt out of certain things. You'd think that, you know, they wanted to know what are their meal preferences, et cetera, et cetera. You'd think at some point in there, they could say, oh yeah, and by the way, do you yeah. want your daughter to share a bed with a biological boy? Right. I mean, it's just, and the fact that they right. didn't to me is outrageous.
Well, specifically when they're also telling parents, no, girls will be on one floor, boys will be right. in another, or girls will be in one cabin, boys will be on another. So, you know, they're not giving all of the information. They're not giving the full picture to parents about all of the opportunities and options that they have when placing your child with a roommate underneath their own policy.
Have you thought about bringing criminal charges against the Jefferson County individuals?
No. What would it be?
Well, we don't really do criminal. So.
Well, you could. You could hire somebody.
Constitutional.
I got lots of good criminal lawyers that would be happy to help you.
What would the charge be, though?
Oh, you know, endangering a child.
Yeah, something like that. That's
there's
true.
There's lots of laws out there that would normally cover something like this, and I think it would be a lot better. It would increase the likelihood that they would acknowledge your one, saying, oh, we've just brought on Harvey Steinberg, and he's gonna appraise us whether we should go to the criminal authorities. You have better chance than the judicial authorities.
To Mallory, to me, the other thing here too is this is in its own way also equally unfair, I think, to the student who identified as a girl, because this kid has now been placed because of stupid adult policies, right? In a weird situation also, right? Because you know how, God knows, fifth and sixth graders like, you know, gossip, right? And so it put everybody mm-hmm. in a bad situation, and well, not everybody, every kid. And I think the fact that these adults with their radical agendas say, you know, parents have no rights, when parents are simply trying to protect and make their kids feel safe and comfortable on what should be a pretty exciting experience. That's just sick on the part of adults, I think.
So who do you address it to? The head of the superintendent of schools, to the board, both?
Both, yes. We sent the letter to the superintendent and the entire board.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, so Mallory, I guess we only have a couple of minutes here. So what are next steps? You're just waiting to hear from them?
Yes, we're waiting to hear from them. They've said that they will respond by the end of the month. And, you know, we're still really hopeful that they would work with us. If they still, though, after our second letter, refuse to provide an opt-out for parents, then we're going to have to talk to our clients and talk to some of the other parents that we've spoken to in the district and decide on the next step.
All right. Well, listen, thank you for your
thank
time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your lifelong
freedom.
That's right. Great. Thank you so much. All right. Thank you very much. Mallory Rechtenbach. All right, with the Alliance Defending Freedom, and we'll keep you posted on what they do. And Leos is another good guest. Thank you. Yes, yeah, she was great. And from Sandra, you're right. Sandra and kids should not have to worry about this BS at all. Dr. Donna says this is also a federal offense. Yeah, curious as to why parents still have their children in public schools. It does. I mean, it didn't even occur to me when Rev was going on his thing. Well, he actually, because they said boys will be in the boy cab and girls will be in the girl cab. And you didn't say...
Boy girls will be in the boy girl cabin.
Right. It's just crazy.
Tomboys will be in either.
Yeah. On Monday, we're going to have Robert Spencer on. We love Robert Spencer to talk about the German farmer protest, which is now it's the France farmer protest. It's the everybody.
Farmer protest.
Yeah. Everybody's there too. And also, I don't know if you guys have been following this. Remember the January 6th pipe bomb that was found there? A lot of it appears.
Good stuff there.
Good stuff there. This is Tucker Carlson did a show on it, the Revolver.com. News has done it too. It appears that the federal government actually planted it and was going to use it as a backup in case their Fed-surrection didn't occur too. So a lot to talk about on Monday. In the meantime, thank you to Lord Conrad Black.
Oh, he was great. Yeah. And Sean Saunders will be fighting this Saturday in the mixed martial arts 297-1. So,
oh, he's the guy that called out the Canadian reporter. All right, yes, okay, that'll do for us. Thank you to
everybody. Thank you, everybody.
Everybody on Zoom. Thank you to the great guys at BBS Radio. It is now time for Party Friday.
Yahoo!